We have one case set for oral argument this afternoon, and I understand that council have all checked in with our court clerk. So without any further ado, the clerk will call the case. We'll get started. I forgot to introduce the panel, although I didn't introduce myself either. To my left is Justice Dabney Basil. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr, as you can see. So thank you. Counsel.
May it please the court. Your Honors, I represent Dr. Clark W. Brazel, who was sued by the estate of Ms. Stokes. I believe she was still alive at the time, and it was a guardianship initially, but she did pass away during the pendency of the litigation. And as I'm sure you're familiar with from the record, the case initially was filed as a series of intentional torts against multiple parties, my client just being one of several defendants. And the way the case was initially pleaded, they took some care to avoid stating it as a medical liability claim. In fact, they talked about that he stepped out of his shoes as his physician to conspire with the other defendants to defraud Stokes.
Well, counsel, isn't it pretty much typical these days that any time a doctor is sued, no matter what it's for, they're going to file a motion to dismiss under the TMLA?
Well, Your Honor, there may be cases where it's not appropriate. I've seen some cases where the doctor was sued for having cattle out on the road, and that was found inappropriate. So just because you're a physician doesn't mean that in every instance you're going to file a motion to dismiss. And in fact, Dr. Brazel submitted this claim to his liability carrier, who refused coverage based upon the nature of the pleading.
To what extent was the denial of coverage explored by the trial court during the three-day hearing? Was that just simply stated that coverage was denied by his carrier, or do we know who the carrier is? Do we know whether there's been any type of eight corners determination in a declaration? Once we determined that it was in fact a health care liability claim, was there any evidence put on whether or not the claim was resubmitted to the carrier and whether or not the carrier was now paying the bills?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Certainly not during the record on the attorney's fees three-day bench trial that we're talking to.
Okay, that's what I want to make sure. If the only thing that was in the record is that his originally, but we don't have a date it was submitted or anything like that to the carrier.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, and the attorney that he hired to represent him was not hired by the carrier to represent him.
It was his personal attorney that he had a long-standing relationship with.
Okay.
But that's the posture in which the suit was initially filed. And it, after Dr. Brazel was brought in, the suit essentially lay dormant for quite some time. The only thing my client did during the first 17 months was to send some written discovery trying to elucidate what it was that he was alleged to have stolen, and didn't get any real response to that. But that was the extent of the discovery that was conducted until July of 2013, when one of the other parties in the case noticed the deposition of Ms. Hillman. And at that point, obviously, my co-counsel, Mr. Leonard, appeared at the deposition and participated in that. And he got information in the course of that deposition that led him to believe that we could get this case dismissed based upon the Medical Liability Act, because Ms. Hillman went much further than her pleadings in stating what the basis of her claim was, and clarified that basically she thought Dr. Brazel didn't diagnose her as being incompetent and didn't protect her from that, as I recall the testimony. But at any event, it was this deposition testimony which this court relied upon.
So up until the deposition, had Dr. Brazel propounded any type of discovery to Ms. Hillman with regard to even a request for disclosure that would have requested the theories of liability against Dr. Brazel?
I believe that, I can't remember if the written discovery was interrogatories or disclosure. I want to say it was disclosure, but I cannot.
Well, you understand a request for disclosure would have, in fact, said, what's your theory against us? And we don't seem, I'm not sure we have that in the record.
I don't know that that is in the record, Your Honor.
Okay, we have a supplemental record that indicates that, that appears to indicate the first time that, Dr. Brazel raises the issue of Chapter 74 applying in any way is in the second amended original answer, which was filed on October 11th of 2013, which is about a year and a half after his original answer. But we don't have the first amended answer. Do you know whether or not the record reflects whether that is, in fact, the first time that Chapter 74 defenses were raised? Because, and I ask that question, is because opposing counsel's brief makes a statement that those were first raised in October 2012. But I couldn't find anything in the record that would support that.
I honestly do not know the answer to that.
Okay. Should we be informed in any way, shape, or form as to how we're going to hold here as to whether or not you could be argued to have sat behind the log with regard to
Well, Your Honor, that was kind of the point I was getting to, that when you talk about sitting behind the log, that would be important if during that 18-month period we were doing a lot of discovery and incurring a lot of fees that we were seeking recovery for, and that's not the case. What really happened was when Ms. Hillman's deposition was noticed, then the wheels began turning, and in fairly short order, we filed our motion to dismiss once we had the information that we felt would convince the court that it needed to be dismissed.
Well, is it accurate, as I think it's in the appellee's brief, that after the time of Ms. Hillman's deposition, between then and when Dr. Brazel filed the motion to dismiss, did lawyers from your firm participate in, I think it was, five other depositions?
That's correct, Your Honor. The other parties were noticing depositions, and my client, who was a co-party in the case, felt like he needed to appear and defend himself.
And that was part of the fees that you were seeking?
That is correct, Your Honor. When you're joined with all these other claims, I think it puts you to an untenable choice to say that, well, I can't participate in these claims because I'm not going to be able to cover these under the Medical Liability Act if I succeed in getting them dismissed. But I just have to go out and defend these with no prospect of recovering those fees.
Yeah. Do we have anything in the record to explain or suggest why there's this gap between July and October?
I believe my co-counsel testified that he needed time to research this. He had to get the deposition back, research it, and get ready to go. I mean, you could argue he could have done it quicker, but I mean, it was not a long period of time between that deposition and when he eventually raised that defense. I don't believe, but that's my understanding from the record, is that it took some time for him to get the issue researched and feel comfortable that he was on firm ground.
Well, then, I'm sorry, counsel, but when you eventually do file the second amended original answer, you assert three defenses in Chapter 74. One, the statute of limitations. Two defenses, actually. The provision of Chapter 74 have not been met, specifically citing Section 74.001 et sec, which would include 351. And you make an affirmative claim for attorney's fees under Chapter 74, 351. So you specifically, in October 11th, okay, you're asserting, and then you file your motion to dismiss. You had filed your motion to dismiss actually 8 days before that. So somewhere in the beginning of October, you're very aware that, or at least it's going to become your policy and your position to the court, that Chapter 74 applies as a healthcare liability claim. Is there some reason why there's not an attempt at that point in time to assert the stay in subsection S?
Your Honor, I don't know why it wasn't asserted, except perhaps I think one reason why is I don't know that the stay could apply to the other parties. What about all these other claims? My reading of the statute says it stays the health care liability claim, but it doesn't stay the other claims. So would the trial court say to the banks or the other defendants that no, you can't proceed with discovery because we've got a potential health care liability claim. And does my client have to sit those out while those proceed on if they're not stayed?
But that issue wasn't determined. Now, this may—I'm not sure. This is something in the record. You might be able to enlighten me. But your client's made an attempt to get coverage. The coverage has been denied. But ultimately, he gets a ruling from this court that says it's a healthcare liability claim. Okay, which should impact his coverage one way or the other. But that doesn't occur for some time after the original attempt to get coverage. Why could you not have simply filed something that asked for the stay to be imposed, something of that nature? Because he clearly is asking for it. Did y'all just rely on the insurer, saying it's not a health care liability claim?
I think the feeling was that the case was going to proceed, and as the trial court ultimately ruled on the motion dismissed, the court denied the relief on that, so I think it would have been a vain gesture to ask for the stay to be imposed as to the entire case. I mean, to say that, well, if we just simply presented that to the trial court, they would have stayed it, I think that's not the way it really would have worked in the real world, Your Honor.
Okay. Why should we not follow a one yi? I can't even pronounce it. I'm sorry.
I'll stipulate to that, Your Honor. I can't pronounce it. Why should we not? Because frankly, the 14th Court of Appeals went much too far. They went beyond the statute and they decided an issue that wasn't necessary to the case. In that case, unlike this one, it was undisputed that the Texas Medical Liability Act applied. The only question was the timeliness of the report. And in the face of that, and in looking at the attorney's fees affidavit, the court said, well, you sent some discovery here that's outside the statute, and in that case, they didn't feel like it was necessary for that to be done. And where it's undisputed, it's clear that the Medical Liability Act applies, I think it would have been fine to say simply, in this case, you didn't need to do any additional discovery. There were no other parties forcing you. There were no other claims. It was a Medical Liability Act claim, and for you to engage in discovery was excessive. And that would be a reasonable thing to do, to say it was unreasonable in this case. But to go beyond that and to say that the statute categorically bars any discovery other than responding to the claimant's permitted discovery in the statute, that's simply not based upon the statutory language.
Let's say we disagree with the 14th Court. Would you not agree, though, that subsection S clearly informs what is determined to be a reasonable fee?
It can in certain cases, Your Honor. If it's clear that the Act applies, if that's not in contention, and the only thing we've got is the timeliness, as in Awonyi, then yes, I think that's something, a factor to be considered. But Awonyi is materially different from this case. This case involved multiple parties and attempt to plead outside the statute. I don't think you can say that the statute bars the fees in this case because it's discovery beyond the statutorily contemplated set of written discovery sent by the claimant. I don't believe that's the only discovery that you can get that constitutes your reasonable fees incurred prior to dismissal under the statute.
But even if we accept that rule, the court still has a measure of discretion to determine what a reasonable attorney's fee is in this case.
The court does have discretion, Your Honor, but it has to act in regard to guiding principles and the law. And in this case, if we had only a ruling of attorney's fees of $44,000 and no explanation, I'd have a much harder time, quite frankly, Your Honor. But in this case, the court told us exactly where the ruling came from. The only thing I'm in doubt on with regard to the court's ruling is the extra $6,000. The appellee seems to think that was an extra $6,000 for discovery. My contention is that the court was awarding an extra $6,000 in light of the three-day hearing and the discovery that was done in conjunction with that.
Wasn't there evidence that the deposition of Hillman cost $3,000 in terms of Dr.
Brazil? That was specific, $3,000, yes.
And would that not have been reasonable for the court to have granted the $3,000 deposition for Ms. Hillman and a similar $3,000 for the deposition of Dr. Brazil?
Well, but that still doesn't add up the math, because there's already 3,000 in there for the Hillman deposition. The 6,000 has to be something else.
Okay.
And they did take depositions of both experts, and then they
so Jackson included the 3,000 for Hillman's deposition.
Yes.
Within his amount.
He allowed nothing post appeal, no fees at all post appeal.
Okay.
I think the trial court was allowing us something on that, but again, there's no standard on it to determine the reasonableness. But in conclusion, Your Honor, I think that we've got a court who says, here's why I ruled this way. I'm relying on the plaintiff's expert, except I'm giving an additional $6,000. And I think based upon that, you can conclude that the court premised its ruling on Iwonyi, and if you disagree with Iwonyi, then the court was acting in reliance on erroneous conclusions of law. And I think that based upon that, the court abused its discretion in awarding attorney's fees on improper theory.
If we agreed with you in that regard, could we, I'm assuming you're asking for remand.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But would we necessarily have to require another evidentiary hearing, since the court has heard all of the testimony? We wouldn't necessarily have to give a second bite at the apple with regard to the presentation.
My only quibble with that would be that I believe we're entitled to attorney's fees up until the point we get a final valid judgment. And that means what the statute contemplates is an order of dismissal with prejudice that awards attorney's fees. Until you get there, you're still incurring attorney's fees. And I'd cite the court to Cruz versus Van Sickle that's in the brief. That was under the anti-SLAPP statute, and it said that, yes, you can get the post-dismissal attorney's fees, that is allowable. So if you remand it, if we have any fees incurred after the appeal, I think that we probably have to have some type
we
of
could
evidence.
We could freeze everything except for the post, for the appellate stuff.
I think you could do that.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Would you add 2 minutes to the appellee's time, please? Counsel.
May it please the court. I think this case is really about statutory interpretation and what does 74351 allow the trial court to consider when it's awarding attorney's fees. And I want to talk about the Awani case a little bit, because I think it's a bit of a paper tiger. That case came up on a different procedural posture. It was a plaintiff who had been subject to an attorney's fees award and argued that the award was too high because the trial court had allowed for fees for discovery beyond subsection F. So this court doesn't have to adopt that rule or not adopt that rule, because there's no cross appeal saying the fees are too high, and the trial court did not base its award strictly on what took place under subsection S. The trial court went a little broader and looked at what was reasonable.
Well, conclusion of law, F finds that the amounts over and above Jackson's testimony were allowable. That's true, but it also specifically cites in conclusion of law E and H Iwonyi specifically, and says that it specifically discounts Brazel's evidence with regard to matters beyond the dismissal.
Right, but then it allows.
And it specifically in H says discovery fees are not recoverable, citing Iwonyi.
It does, but it also says it's making the award more broadly, considering the statute and the purpose of the statute and what's reasonable. And I think if we were just going to look at what was awarded in Iwonyi, then the Hillman deposition would be out and the additional 20 hours would be out. So, because those are not contemplated by subsection S either. But I think the trial court understood, based on the circumstances of this case, that that additional discovery was perhaps necessary to conclude that this was, in fact, a health care liability claim.
Okay, so basically, which one of the conclusions of law is incorrect here? Because two of them are they're all three pretty categorical.
Right.
So I'm going to follow Iwonyi on two of them, and on the other one I don't have to.
Okay.
So how are we to find that the application of the law was done correctly for purposes of reaching the conclusion that the trial court reached?
Well, I think the trial court could consider Awanyi and the principles therein without adopting its strict interpretation in terms of, only subsection S is allowed. So I think the trial court could cite to Awanyi for sort of the general principle without wholesale adopting Awanyi, given the distinctions between the factual distinctions.
Are we to ignore the fact the court specifically said he found Jackson to be credible, and Jackson specifically testified that Awanyi controls, and you cannot have anything other than the dismissal?
Well, Jackson testified to that, but he also testified. Jackson also permitted fees for the Hillman deposition. So even Jackson said, "This is what Awanyi says," but more broadly, the issue is what's reasonable under the statute. And so in this case, given the posture of the claims, it was reasonable to allow for a little more than what Awanyi would have allowed for if you read that case very strictly.
So are you advocating that not that we would have to make this a holding, but that we should be comfortable with the idea of sort of rough justice under particular facts as part of the court's discretion?
Well, I I think the term reasonable allows the trial court to exercise discretion. And I think that reasonable needs to be tethered to the statute and what the statute contemplates.
So in other words, you don't have a problem with what I said earlier about subsection S informing what is reasonable but not controlling
exactly. What
is reasonable.
Exactly. Okay. The statute has to be read as a whole, and the trial court has discretion to determine what's reasonable. And so I think there's a tendency in this case to look down and say, well, they should have pled it this way, and Dr. Brazel should have known earlier. And I think the trial court is in the best position. She had this case for 18 months to see what's gone on and to sort of award the fee based on her knowledge of how parties are operating and based on good faith. I didn't know if you had a follow-up question.
No, I was sure.
I wanted to give you that record site on the October 31st, 2012 First Amended petition. It's an exhibit. It's a trial exhibit. So it's 6RR and it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 12.
So it is in the record.
It is in the record.
And it's 1031?
It's 12. It's Plaintiff's Exhibit 12.
It was filed October?
October 31st, 2012.
And did it contain anything that would touch on the statute?
I believe it was they put in an affirmative defense under the statute.
Okay.
So to indicate, that they were perhaps aware.
So a year, a year before the motion to dismiss was actually filed?
Correct.
Okay.
But I also, going back, we're under a lodestar analysis, which also sort of is looking at what's objectively reasonable in terms of the attorney fee. And so I think that sort of does implicate what would an objectively reasonable attorney do given the status of Texas law, given what we know about the TMLA and presumptions that arise when a doctor is sued and his or her behavior or treatment is implicated, a presumption arises that's a healthcare liability claim. And when, the panel in Brazil 1 assessed whether it was a healthcare liability claim, they were looking at that complaint, the First Amended complaint, and they were able to make the determination based on the First Amended complaint. So I think there's a notion that an objectively reasonable attorney...
Well, the First Amended complaint is the first time Dr. Brazil is mentioned, correct?
Correct.
And so assuming how those things usually happen under the eight-corner rule, that pleading is sent to his carrier. Carrier's put on notice a claim's been made against him, and the carrier said, we're looking at the eight corners. We don't see a healthcare liability claim based upon the First Amendment petition from Ms. Hillman.
Mm-hmm.
So how are we to take that as part of the record.
I think it's hard to know without a full record on the policy and what the carrier's determination was. I mean, it's hard for me to say without looking at the policy, you know, what the basis for that decision was. But certainly, you know, out of abundance of caution, I think as a healthcare provider.
Would that not implicate what was reasonable under the circumstances if the doctor is not being, his backside's not being covered by the policy, and all of this is going to be coming out of his own personal hide? Would that not be something that the trial court could take into consideration in determining what's reasonable? Because what's reasonable when your own skin is in the game as opposed to an insurer's skin might be a little bit different. Do you not think?
I think the trial court certainly could take that into consideration. Yeah. But it seems if you know that you're not going to be covered, you have even more of an incentive to promptly move forward with a motion to dismiss to try to expedite the claim. And I understand that there was obviously a good faith dispute over whether these claims were healthcare liability claims. I mean,
and I would assume that it wouldn't be admissible if a doctor moves to dismiss under Chapter 24 and the plaintiff comes back and says, well, your carrier has denied coverage, so therefore even they agree with us that it's not a health care liability claim.
Right. I don't think the carrier's determination is dispositive one way or the other.
So.
I mean, I suppose the trial court could consider it, but it's it would not be dispositive. Obviously, the Texas Supreme Court controlling authority would come in. And I also kind of want to touch on the sort of the policy if the court were to sort of adopt Dr. Brazil's sort of reading of the statute, which would be to entitle him to all of his attorney's fees and entitle any doctor similarly situated to their attorney's fees if they sort of wait and don't promptly pursue their motion to dismiss. And I think we know, you know, the Texas Supreme Court tells us that a doctor can wait. They don't even have to pursue interlocutory appeal. They could wait to the end of a case and still, as part of their appeal after a termination on the merits, argue that an expert report was insufficient and try to seek fees and costs. And so if we're going to allow fees and costs through the entire course of litigation, you know, there's sort of an incentive for a doctor to sit back and not raise it, or at least not pursue an appeal if they lose, in hopes that they may garner more fees. And I'm not suggesting that that's what happened in this case.
Are you aware of any doctor who would just like to sit back and watch as his or her care is being litigated in front of a jury, even if he's not an actual party?
I'm not, but I mean, the doctor waited 18 months here, right? So we want to incentivize people to be prompt.
Well, the doctor in Jernigan versus Langley waited 600 days. Supreme Court said that was not a waiver of the right to seek dismissal under the old statute. Let me ask you this. Do we need to find any significance about both the old statute and the new statute? Both use the words reasonable and incurred. Neither one uses the word necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The only difference in the statutes that I can see is that under the old 4590I, the amount that was awarded as sanctions, quote unquote, as sanctions. Okay. And it could be awarded against both the plaintiff and the plaintiff's attorney, or one or the other, and the access to the attorney was deleted, as was the mention of as sanctions. Since that was taken out, is there anything, particularly in Garcia, that you see as the Supreme Court saying that somehow reduces the type of discretion that is available to a trial court in making an award under the circumstances? Because here you actually had the trial court made a determination, okay, that there was not the availability of a jury trial for purposes of the amounts because he held as a matter of law that this was a sanction, even though as sanctions had been specifically removed from the statute. Okay? So he's made a determination that this is still, he's doing this as sanctions, which is why he deprived Dr. Brazel of the right of a jury trial.
I think she.
She, I'm sorry. I keep saying that. So, are you arguing that in some way the new statute grants more discretion than under the old statute? Or is it pretty much the same?
I would say it's the same. And I do think, in this case, the parties specifically chose to use the Lodestar method. So they sort of embraced a method that that takes into account reasonable and necessary. So,
and is there even a clear line of demarcation? If there is one, I'm not aware of.
Right.
Where reasonableness leaves off and necessity picks up. I mean, they sort of slop over to some extent.
They do.
Don't they?
I mean, I think you could argue that something, an attorney could be charging a reasonable fee and the work could be reasonable, but could perhaps not be necessary for the case. But I think I think work that's unnecessary seems to be unreasonable. Maybe if there's a Venn diagram, there's a kind of an overlap.
Well, the court made it clear in Garcia that ideally reasonable and incurred would be the same amount.
Right. So. Right. But it's...
which suggests that incurred could be unreasonable in some way, shape, or form.
Right, right. You don't just get everything. You have to have some, it has to be incurred, but it also has to be reasonable. So just because you incur it doesn't mean you get it. It's a floor ceiling. But I think I've made the points I want to make if the panel has no further questions.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Key.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. I think the court has discretion as to what is reasonable, but not what is recoverable. The court can look at this and say, well, I think you spent too long doing this particular action. But if it's covered under the statute, the court doesn't have the right to say, well, that's just not recoverable because that's outside the statute. This is a mandatory attorney's fees statute. It's not the court has discretion and can take into consideration equity and justice and all that. The statute says that when you get a dismissal under the Medical Liability Act, you get your reasonable attorney's fees incurred in the claim. Now, let me be a little more precise. It says you get awards to the affected physician or healthcare provider reasonable attorney's fees and cost of court incurred by the physician or healthcare provider. It doesn't even say about the claim. Now, obviously, I guess if we were litigating a claim for non-payment or something as a counterclaim or brought something that clearly had no application to being a defendant in this, then that might be outside the statute, and the court could say, you don't get attorney's fees for that. But I think that a defendant who is in a posture of having been brought into a multi-party lawsuit with multiple theories, I think that the defendant's entitled to do anything that a defendant would do in reasonable circumstances under those cases. Now, we also talked about another point here that filing an interlocutory appeal is not mandatory. You can go on to final judgment and then bring all this up. Suppose we'd had a motion for summary judgment on limitations coupled with the motion to dismiss, and the court says, well, I'm not giving you a motion to dismiss, but I'll give you your limitations. You could appeal that and say that we should have been awarded our attorney's fees, it should have been dismissed with prejudice, and I think you'd be entitled to get all your fees incurred in presenting that motion on both theories, because it's something that a defendant would do to defend themselves under the Act. So I think that there are multiple ways.
Of course, the statute of limitations, it would depend on which statute of limitations you were asserting. If you asserted the Chapter 74 statute of limitations and the court granted it on that basis, then that would be a determination.
Well,
it's a health care liability claim.
I mean, surely that would be a more of a clear-cut case.
Understood.
But
Okay, I'm going to sandbag you now, okay? But I'm going to give you, if my colleagues agree, I'll be happy to give you an opportunity to respond. You ever heard of a man by the name of Ronald Hole, H-O-L-E?
No, you're not.
He's an attorney who represents doctors down in the Corpus area. And counsel took the position, she didn't think reasonableness and incurred are really that much different under the old statute and the new statute. And there's a couple of Corpus Christi cases that appear to be pretty much on point with regard to this issue. One is a case called Clinica Santa Maria versus Martinez. And in that case, Mr. Hole was seeking $135,000, but the trial court awarded $972 because Mr. Hole, during the evidentiary hearing, testified that $972 was all that he incurred in preparing and presenting the motion to dismiss. And the Court of Appeals affirmed that $972 because they found that all the other things being considered, it was reasonable to simply award the $972. Were you aware of that particular case?
I have read that case, Your Honor, and I think that there may be a case where you could gild the lily and lay it on. That's entirely possible. But I also think, just speaking practically, that there's a tendency on the part of the healthcare providers not to appeal these, to take them all the way, because you're usually dealing with judgment-proof healthcare claimants. So
well, and sometimes the healthcare providers didn't ask for attorney's fees. Jernigan versus Langley, there's no remand for attorney's fees. Jernigan never asked for them. Okay?
As a practical matter.
It depended. But is there something wrong with the reasoning in Clinica Santa Maria?
If I can recall, I believe, I can't recall if they cited Ohlone on that.
No, it's a 2010 case. I don't believe they cite Ohlone on it. I'm sorry, I got the number wrong. It's $997.50.
Your Honor, I have it in my briefing notes. I think that, you know, when there, it's clearly excessive, I think the court can say that it's unreasonable. That's allowed under the statute. And engaging in excessive discovery would certainly be something to consider on that regard. But I don't believe it's correct to say that you can only recover for the discovery under the laundry list in the statute.
Thank you, Counselor. Your time's up. All right, we appreciate the argument. It's been very helpful. And with that, your case is dismissed, and we will stand adjourned.